Iran, as well as peacemakers in our nation's capital who are confronting war hawks in the White House and in Congress and modeling the actions we want our government to take. Again, that's Code Pink Radio, Thursdays at 11 a.m. on Washington, D.C.'s WPFW and New York City's WBAI, an engaging hour of cutting-edge conversation not to be missed.
I'm Candy Shannon in Washington.
Welcome to On the Margin with E. Ethelbert Miller. My guest today is Keith Gilyard. Keith Gilyard is the Edward Earl Sparks Professor of English and African American Studies at the Pennsylvania State University and a former president of the National Council of Teachers. Keith Gilyard has two new books published this year, The Promise of Language, a memoir published by Wayne State University Press, and On Location, a collection of poems published by Third World Press Foundation. How are you doing this morning, Keith?
I'm great, man. Thanks for having me.
Got to talk to you, brother.
I'm on it.
Yeah. Okay. You know, let's begin, Keith, with the title of your memoir, The Promise of Language. You mentioned in the author's note that this book is about how language shapes lives and how lives shape language. Elaborate on that.
Well, you know, language is the key for me. And in some ways, the book could have been called The Promise of Education or The Promise of the Life of the Mind. But when I drill down on that, you know, thinking about education, an educated life, a life of the mind, language is at the core of that, right? The language that you're exposed to, that you gravitate toward, and that you keep with you as a lifelong gift from the community, really. And so that's what I was thinking about, the promise of language, because you can't get through the other stuff unless you have a certain relationship with the language. And so that's what I was thinking about the title.
You know, later on in your book, there's a discussion, I think you're talking about Lorenzo Thomas's work, and there's a reference that you make about how to live on the frontier of language. Right. And I was wondering, what did you mean by that?
That's what our professor told us. I had Professor Stephen Sapanchez when I was at Queens College, and I was in his poetry writing class. And when I got in there, all he would talk about was Lorenzo Thomas.
Right.
Because Lorenzo had been his student before me. And so he would say, you got to be like Lorenzo, Lorenzo Thomas, Lorenzo Thomas. And so that's when I really read Lorenzo stuff, you know, and got into Lorenzo. But then what he told us, he said, mind language, live on the frontier language, like always push it, you know, don't always go for the received language or the received wisdom, always like try to push the boundary a little bit. So, I think about that. I don't know how well I did it or do it, but I tried to keep that in mind. James Baldwin told me something similar when I met him. He said, work the language, work the language. And so and he said, any advice I have, but just work the language. And so that's what I was thinking about.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you mentioned, you know, early in your book, about this thing about language. You talk about the language of the streets, and it seems as if this is the language that seduces and traps you to some extent. It opens the door to crime and drugs. And after I read my show, and I said this to you, you were a lucky person. You're a very lucky person, you know.
No question.
Right? And you make reference to Claude Brown's Man Child in the Promised Land, and I want to talk about Brown's book and the relationship to your own memoir.
Well, you know, as I mentioned in the book, Claude Brown and I, we're from the same block, really. I mean, he lived on 146th Street. I lived right around the corner. But of course, there's an age difference. But he went to the same elementary school that I went to. He talks about it in his memoir. He went to the same park, Colonial Park. He talks about that in the book. It's called Jackie Robinson Park now. A number of the sites that he mentioned, you know, that he mentions in his memoir, those are sites I'm familiar with, you know, same places. So when I was in high school, I read that book, you know, because they had us reading Thomas Hardy and stuff like that. That's about when I was getting ready to tune out, you know, like, I'm not really, you know, when you got older, you appreciated Thomas Hardy, but not at 17. And so I think my sister might have told me about that book because she was the one that put me onto a lot of stuff.
That was a big book back then.
Yeah, but it was when I started reading it, I was like, this is my book, you know?
Right.
So, I mean, I read that thing and maybe I stayed up all night. I wasn't doing homework by then. I'll stay up all night and read that book. And so just that book, that world, even though as I got old, I realized, you know, some of the liberties and some of the exaggerations, but, you know, I dial that back. But yeah, that was really inspirational for me always. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know,
to me, that's like reading the autobiography of Malcolm X.
Exactly. You know, you mentioned something in your book, and I want you to look beyond your life because you're talking mm-hmm. about other people. You mentioned your book that around the third grade is key. Mm-hmm. And you say that it's at a point where some Black children fall behind. And I was wondering, you know, if you could elaborate on that. And when you're talking about Black children falling behind, are you talking about Black boys falling behind or Black girls or all Black children?
I think Black children in general, probably boys more if you break mm-hmm. it out gender wise. But what I was referring to is what is in a lot of the educational literature. And test after test, study after study has shown this, is that, and so this is why when they start talking about deficit or early deficits and stuff like that, we know that that's specious because kindergarten, first grade, second grade, you know, they're right in step. And so I can't say it as graphically as I said it in the book, but it seems that by third grade, they have a certain awareness about right. why the culture views them. And that goes into how they develop their relationship with the wider culture, in particular, the educational system that they're a part of. And so that becomes the problem. You know, I remember reading the book, I think it was a Herb Cole book, and he had elementary school class. He was taking them on a field trip, and they went by Teachers College, you know, Columbia University. Right. And then the kids were like, "What's that building?" And he said, "Oh, that's what teachers are written there." They said, "Oh, you know, we can go past this one," you know. So so they had developed a certain relationship because they know they're smart enough by 9, 10, 8 to know how they're being perceived. Hmm. And that's so that's beyond me. I didn't actually have that particular experience, but that's what you see over and over again in the literature and what I've seen over and over again in the world, you know.
What about the people looking at and talk about within the African-American household, single parents versus, you know, mothers and fathers being in there? Do you see that factor in looking at your own life because you have a separation there between your parents?
Yeah, when you go back, I mean, I never was put on the couch to talk about all this stuff.
Well, you're on the couch now, brother.
I see. So, you know, I mean, you can't unravel it all. I mean, how it is when you look back, you know, you're not 100% reliable witness and whatnot. But I'm sure that, I can imagine being, you know, 9 or whatever, but I can't really be 9. So I'm sure it has impacts and whatnot. But I think that... It's when you look at the literature and whatnot, I think it's probably over exaggerated because I think it has a lot to do with whatever that support system is. It doesn't have to be a nuclear family. It doesn't have to be a two-parent family. It can be a one-parent family just as well. You know, sometimes it's not even a separation. It could be a death or whatever. Mm-hmm. Person not doomed because of a one-parent household. Right. There are some things, you know, there are some factors. You know, there was, you know, like for me, there was no man to keep me in check. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if I could have been kept in check anyway.
I don't think you could be kept in check, brother. There's something wrong with you, brother.
So, you know, that's the way it is. Yeah.
Well, you know, in 1958, your family moved from Harlem to Corona, Queens. Talk about Corona, Queens. Talk about that neighborhood. I think of Louis Armstrong. I think of a lot of people who moved to that neighborhood. But right. flesh that out, you know, and what does it mean? What did it mean for your family to move from Harlem to Corona, Queens?
Okay. I think it was a big step. You know, when I go back and think about it, I think my mother was probably the driving force with that. And I think I talk about that because I see her as the striver. The one who wanted, you know, to pursue upward mobility, as they say, right? And so I don't know how responsible my father was in that regard. It turns out to be not too responsible, to tell you the truth, you know, with gambling and all that stuff. But I think it was a big deal. There were a lot of advertisements and papers. That whole area was being pushed, like Corona, East Elmhurst, that whole area. And so it was definitely seen as a move, an upward mobility move. You know, get out of Harlem, you know, get off 146th Street. And back then they called it Long Island, you know, so well, you're moving out to Long Island.
Right, right.
They used to call Queens Long Island. And technically it is. But yeah, that was a big move. And we moved into, you know, a house, you know, they bought a house. We moved into a house. That was the plan, you know, two family house, rent out the upstairs, live downstairs. And so, you know, you're well on your way, you know, through the middle class, you know,
right.
you go to the elementary school, you go to the Jewish elementary school, which just happened to be up the block. We didn't even have to be bused for that, you know? And so, yeah, that was it. And that's where the, what you're talking about earlier, that's where the two parent piece comes in, because if you hold together like that, you can make it economically, right? Mm-hmm. But it's not so much the psychological and all the other stuff, but if that union falls apart, then you're in trouble economically. And so, but Corona was seen as upward mobility, but it's a bit of a strange neighborhood. Because it has a pocket. It has a pocket that was called Little Harlem.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't live in Little Harlem when we first moved out there. We lived on a tree-lined street and stuff like that. But only with the collapse of the nuclear family that we had to move into an apartment. And then we were in Little Harlem.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't, and so were areas of blight and whatnot. So it wasn't the whole neighborhood. But it was certain parts of the neighborhood. I just happened to land in that part.
Mm-hmm.
I was only three or four blocks from Louis Armstrong.
Yeah, you know, when I listen to you talk about this, Keith, I'm looking at how your life is different because, you know, you moved into a house. For me,
yeah.
It's like the housing projects.
So
there's a housing project. There's a house. You know, we want a house, but we're in the housing project. You know, and so that I think that affects a lot of things. But you know, when I saw happening in your house,
that's why I made the point. You know, I would say like, we lived in a house. Because I didn't want to devolve into this is poor boy from the ghetto story. You know, it's a different kind of story. I'm not the worst of the worst. I didn't have the worst of circumstances, but you know, we go through stuff, you know.
Right. Well, you know what I like about your book? You take us into the household, you know, like there are a number of people right now who are writing memoirs, but they're not being very specific. You know, when I'm reading your book and the thing about, okay, you're messing up and your mother gets that iron cord from the iron, you know, that was when there's probably some people who have those scarifications on their butt right now from the iron cord.
I bet you for sure. We all know, a lot of us know that one for sure. Yeah, that's what they knew.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she did the best she could. You know, my mother just passed in December.
Oh, okay.
So I just lost her. She's the influence. No magic is her. Mm-hmm. I think it's like you falling, but she's the one to pull you through.
Right.
Sure.
Well, you know, you also made it through, you talk about this, that you needed sports, that sports played a key role in your development, and maybe sports might have even saved your life. Talk about sports and the different types of sports that you were involved in.
Man. Yeah, I don't know, from a little kid, along with the language, it was definitely sports. I was gravitated towards sports. Baseball first, of course, which you will appreciate.
Mm-hmm.
Yankee Stadium used to be my babysitter, as a matter of fact. I had an aunt that lived in the Bronx. And one summer I was staying with her, but she was working. You know, she had she was in real estate and some other things. She had a restaurant on Lenox Avenue. And so she would get me and she would drop me off at Yankee Stadium and she would tell me, okay, here's where you meet me.
Yeah, Jerome Avenue,
after
right?
After the game is over. So she would be on her rounds, and she would have the game on the radio. You know, so she knew eighth inning, ninth inning, let me head toward the ballpark and pick him up. Because she lived on University Avenue, right off the Major Deacon. So we could walk down University Avenue. We could walk to the stadium from there. It's like a 10-minute walk. And so baseball, and then I was born near the Polo Grounds.
The Giants, yeah.
Yeah, the Giants were still there. As a toddler, I don't have memory of this, but I know that I went to Ebbets Field, and my mother dragged me to Ebbets Field. She was an incurable Brooklyn Dodgers fan.
But we have pictures of you on playing with Sickball Willie Mays, isn't it?
No, that's not me. I wish. I wish. He was out there. But Yeah, so baseball first. You know, I think one thing's about baseball, and you can talk about this, but I think one of the things about baseball is that you can probably play it first. You know, like if you think about other sports, you're not big enough. Like you don't have equipment to get on a football field, or you don't want to be out there six getting banged around anyway. In basketball, right. you're not strong enough to really shoot the ball up to the hoop. But baseball, you know, you can get a stick ball and a rubber ball and whatnot. And
it was a Spalding back then.
Yeah, Spalding. You got Pinsy Pinky, one or the other, right?
Right.
You know, and yeah, you could get on that early, you know. And so baseball, and then the community back then, I think baseball was our sport. Mm-hmm. I think it's been superseded by basketball. But I think back when I was a shorty, it seems like baseball and boxing, those were our sports, man. Those are like the civil rights sports.
Mm-hmm. Was there a boxer that you were? Well, you were like you were a Sonny Liston guy.
Sonny Liston was my guy, man.
The beer.
Oh yeah, because they hated Sonny, and Sonny had a reputation, and you heard about the stuff he could do. He knocking out prison guards and all that. It's like he was Stagger Lee, you know.
Right.
Stagger Lee, Sonny, that's my guy. And then Doug Jones is from Harlem. So,
oh, Doug, yeah.
And Doug is the matter of fact. Doug Jones is the person. That's referred to in the early pages of Claude Brown's book.
Mm-hmm.
So that was his childhood friend. And so early in Manchild, when Sonny, he uses the name Sonny in the book, when he's shot and the guy runs and he says, "Oh, don't leave me." That's Doug Jones.
Oh, okay.
Who fought the young Cassius Clay, of course. And I rooted for Doug Jones because, you know, it's Harlem, you know? So, yeah, but boxing and baseball, and you know, life is all about baseball, Ethelbert, you know that. You know?
Why don't you read Game Time that's in your book on location?
Game Time?
Yeah.
Oh, man. My daughter and I were talking about that the other day. Because
this takes you out to the ballpark and you have your family, yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is after the separation that you talked about. So my dad was a deacon in the church, and I was still going uptown. I was living in Queens at the time, but we were still going back uptown to church. And so one day after Sunday service, I was coming out the church and I saw my dad. And he was like, "Man, you want to go to the ball game?" I'm like, "Yeah, you know, back then." That's before I converted to the Mets. You know, it was all about the Yankees, man. Sure. Let's go out to the ball game. So he just took me. So I thought he had cleared it.
Mm-hmm.
He talked to my mother, so we going to the ball game. So we went out to the ball game. It was a doubleheader, and he hadn't said anything to her. He just got me, you know. Mm. So it was fun, you know. So this Game Time, this is a reflection on that day, really. Let me see. If I weren't grieving, I would rebuild the original Yankee Stadium. Take the same wooden seat next to the bullpen where Bill Stafford scared me with a black rubber spider on my arm and you thought it funny. Easy price to pay to see Luis Aparicio, Hector Lopez, and of course, Mickey Mantle, and Yogi Berra, and a Mouskarin home run, and Ralph Terry actually winning, becoming a little more cool with me after the tough Bill Mazeroski situation. White Sox grabbed the nightcap while I failed to realize I'm not even authorized to be at this game. Yeah, you pops, but you don't live with us anymore. And Ma don't know you approached me after Sunday morning service to spend these lovely hours in the Bronx. It's almost 10 p.m. when I face Mama's wrath at 10 years old. And the fastball and the curveball and all the missing persons panic while you leave me at the front door and dash like the great Aparicio stealing another base. If I weren't grieving, I would be laughing too.
Listening to Keith Gilyard reading his poem, Game Time, from his book, On Location. You know, there's another place. I like this poem, Keith, because it deals with, you know, almost like fathers playing catch with their sons and stuff.
Oh.
But there's another thing important in your book that I wish you had expanded on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's later on where you are helping your father do math so that he could take the test for the post office.
Yeah.
And I just thought about, you know, this whole thing where you're the son, you're teaching your father something. And I was just wondering, would, you know, how did, you know, just what was happening in that relationship? Because all of a sudden now your father's looking at you to help him something. And it's key for his, you know, taking the test.
Oh, man, he needed that test, no doubt. You know, it was, you know, when I was a kid, my dad, he used to come in. I don't know where he used to get these books from. Because he never, you know, he never went past elementary school, but he always valued education. You know, he valued that. My mother valued that, and he used to come when he still lived with us. He used to come home and he used to have these problems, and it'd be math problems. And he used to give these problems to my sister and I, and my younger sister too. The baby was too young; she couldn't fool with it. But he would say, solve these problems. And then if you solve them, he would give you some money. And then I was getting all the money. So he had to spread it out because I really took the math. And so was kind of known for that. Math was always my best subject in school. That's what gets me to Stuyvesant High, right? It's a math and science school. And so he valued that. He was around. But my father, I could always find him, you know. So I had a relationship to him that my sisters didn't have because they didn't really see him. But I was the go-between. Mm-hmm. Need something, you know where your father lives, right? Go find your father. Right. So we had that kind of relationship. I didn't see him a whole lot because he worked all kind of different things and hours and whatnot. But it was always about school. Mm-hmm. School. One time I ran into him at the ballpark too. I was playing hooky and ran into him. He was like, what are you doing there? I said, oh, we had a half a day. we had a half a day, you know. So he was always supportive, you know, supportive of anything that was involving education. And so when I would talk to him and he was like, man, I'm trying to get this job in the post office. And I was like, man, Pops, you have so many jobs, man. This your last shot. You know how they told us.
Right.
Get that good post office job, I said.
And benefits.
Yeah, he was in his mid-40s by then. He was coming up on 45, you know. And so he was like, I need you to help me, you know, get ready for this test. Mm-hmm. So that's what we did, you know. Yeah. And whatever else I was running around doing, I said, oh, I got to go see Pops, man, help him with this algebra and stuff like that. So
yeah, I just circled that in your book when I was reading it. Like, I said, you know,
I wish I'd expanded on it more as well. You know,
right.
I think that's a good critique. Yeah. I wish I'd said more about it, but you know.
Well, you do mention in your book something which I think affects us as African-American writers, and you make a reference to Baraka about this. Comics, you know, because I remember Barack was like a Green Lantern guy, you know.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
But talk about that, and then also talk about African American music.
The comics books. I mean, that was the world. You know, we were surrounded with, like you said, it was sports. You know, baseball and boxing for me, and then the comic books were part of it. You know, you're elementary school kid, you go into the convenience store.
But you were a Dell guy. You were a Marvel. I don't think you were a Marvel guy.
No, I was a DC guy.
DC guy. This is what I'm talking about. You see, you got to break it down.
Yeah, I'm DC. I'm Superman, and I'm Superman all the way. But part of that's because of the TV show,
right?
You know, because we watched Superman was on TV. And so Superman was the guy. Marvel, I don't know about you guys yet. So when I got to junior high school, a lot of people big into Marvel, but I wasn't reading comic books by then. So they were getting into the Submariner and all that. I wasn't reading.
Right.
I wasn't reading that by then. To me, it was Aquaman. I don't need Submariner.
No, and what about the music? And talk about the music that you're hearing in your house and maybe the music that you're hearing out on the street.
In the house, it was, as I said, it was the Jocko show for me early, you know.
Yeah, you begin with that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The Jocko, that's it, man. And heard that in the house. My dad, because he had been in the military, I think he had exposure to big band music. Mm-hmm. So he knew Count Basie and he knew other big band leaders and whatnot. He was familiar with them. And so I would hear that stuff with him. And then I would hear all the, you know, the what they would call R&B later, but the R&B and all that, I heard that on the radio and then, you know, stuff like that. And then it's in the streets. And that's why I end the book the same way. It's like, I end the book, I said, there's another, there's another little 4 or 5 year old going down the street, not paying attention to his mother, and the music is in the air, you know, so it's full, it comes full circle.
Well, you got, why don't you read Blue Train on 109th Street?
Cause Blue Train?
Yeah.
Oh, man, my daughter keeps quizzing me about that poem. She's like, and she knows what, and she knows what it means, but she wants me to say it. she wants me to say it, you know. What page is that?
Page 54.
54? All right, let me find that. Blue Train. Yeah, Train was, I used to play my favorite things every time I had a boxing match. I used to play it before I left the house.
That's like your walk-up music.
I know. That was my get my hit right music and whatever, you know. So, yeah, Train, you know, that's one of my regrets is that, you know, well, not my regret. It's not for me to regret that he passed so young. But I wish I'd have been able to hear him live.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you could have stuck off from Corona to the Greenwich Village and, you know, catch him there.
Yeah. Blue Train on 109th Street, which is in Corona, right? Coltrane rolls the blue train through your bedroom of weed and Buddhist chants and the age disparities being negotiated. You know how to lay it down. I'm learning how to pick it up. Agreeing on politics makes a difference, and Lee Morgan is curious about the outcome of sparks merging in dancing shadows framed by dim light. Locomotives are always a tease. We know enough eventually to accept the color. What makes it blue? It has to move on down the line.
Listening to Keith Gilley.
That's about Train's album.
All right, we're listening to Keith Gilley. I read his poem on Blue Train on 109th Street from his book On Location. Talk about, music in terms of how it has changed in terms of if you were a young writer coming up today, what would probably be the music that would enter into your poetry?
I can't imagine it not being hip hop. You know, mm-hmm. I can't imagine it not being hip hop. It'd probably be a fight. Matter of fact, hip hop has seeped in. Mm-hmm. I've written some hip hop poems, even, you know, as a member of my generation. So that influence is so pervasive. I can't imagine it not coming in. I think it's a battle. It'd probably be a battle to keep it from taking over completely. Because mm-hmm. even sometimes. You know, I would think about stuff and then I would start rhyming and stuff like that. I say, no, I don't want to do that.
Right.
I'm not a hip hop poet, you know. So I can't imagine that not being in there for sure. And I can't imagine. I think also I'd be like sort of struggling with the influences of spoken word mm-hmm. as well.
Well, let's talk about that because you're at Pennsylvania State University. Mm-hmm. You're teaching African-American studies and African-American literature. How do you now talk about the tradition, you know, in terms of, you know, looking at how hip hop is constantly changing, that if you introduce mm-hmm. it into the curriculum, it could mm-hmm. be something like somebody said, well, I don't listen to that anymore.
Yeah, you know? that's old school, you know.
Right.
Yeah, I try to sort of talk about it that way, you know, that it's ever evolving. I don't try to be the expert on the contemporary or what's jumping off like right now, because as you mm-hmm. say, that thing changes. And I've had to go through this with students. I've had graduate students. They say, "Oh yeah, I'm gonna be a hip hop scholar. I'm gonna do my dissertation on hip hop." And I said, "Well, let's talk," because they would say, "Well, you know, when I was in high school, blah blah blah." I said, "You know what? By the time you finish this dissertation, you'd be like 30 years old, and you go talk to some 16-year-olds, and they think they be calling you pops. You know,
hey.
It's like that. The thing changes so fast that to try to be an expert on it, you know, you have to have a different paradigm that you're coming from where you account for the evolution as part of your work.
But if you look at the other part of our literature, you know, you wouldn't leave out like Richard Wright or Toni Morrison.
Oh, never, you know,
right.
But I know a lot of people do, you know, but I wouldn't because it all goes together for me. It's all one grand expressive tradition.
Okay, well, we just expressed ourselves for a half hour, so we're going to take a little break, okay? My guest today is Keith Gilyard. He is the Edward Earl Sparks Professor of English and African-American Studies at Pennsylvania State University. We're talking about his two new books, The Province of Language, a memoir, and also On Location. My name is E. Ethelbert Miller. The show's On the Margin. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
This is your social justice calendar for the week of June 30th, 2025. On Saturday, July 5th at 3 p.m., DMV Palestinian Youth Movement will host Liberation Imagined, a community art event on 650 Pennsylvania Avenue Southeast. For more info, please visit the Instagram at DMVPYM. WPFW Social Justice Calendar connects you to grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. This is due by Thursday at 5 p.m. at least 1 week in advance of your event. WPFW Social Justice Calendar helps build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Okay, we're back on the margin with my friend Keith Gilyard. Keith, around the fifth grade, you started writing poetry. And by the sixth grade, you were writing about how, you talked about how you were dealing with current events like the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. When I read your memoir, I felt like the voice of the book is an adult and not a child coming of age. You know, like you like saying, "Well, let me tell you what about such and such, you know." If you we're like I tell people, like I didn't know what was going on, you know. But I was wondering whether you did that in terms of, okay, going back now and say, okay, I'm going to put this in a wider context. You know, mm-hmm. I'm doing this. I might be playing, going to a baseball game, but this is what's happening in the world.
Right. I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, those things. Like talking about being in the barbershop and the kind of student I was in school, especially discussing a lot of things. I was always talking about the Holocaust with my Jewish schoolmates and whatnot. I really was very aware of what was going around in terms of the larger culture.
That's why you went to Stuyvesant and I went to Columbus High School. See, this is right there. This is the separation right there. You were smart and I was stupid.
No, it wasn't that. But it was just a certain acuteness, I guess.
Right.
I think some of what you're saying is fair, though. I mm-hmm. think anytime you're looking back, I think some of it is you know, you're infusing adult perspective into past events. Mm-hmm. I think it's hard to disentangle that.
Well, you know, when you say that, but the reason why I always say that, the book that made me aware of that was when Baraka wrote his memoir. Mm-hmm. And he was like, you know, he's like, well, I knew about the class struggle when I was 80.
No. that I'm not buying, you know. I mean, when he opens up, like his analysis of the family, you know, that's very good. We had the Browns and the Yellows and the Blacks and all of that. And he went to Roosevelt Stadium to watch baseball, right? Mm-hmm. Negro League baseball.
Right, like he's a Newark Eagles baseball. Or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah,
right.
Newark Eagles. Yeah. But I think that's fair. I think that's a fair observation, Ethelbert, that is the voicing, you know, is I don't want to call it problematic because it's done. I'm not doing it over, but I think that I think that's a fair observation.
Yeah. Well, you know, if I was teaching your book in a memoir class, I felt that your best writing in this book is pages 80 to 81, which would probably get you banned also because it's so descriptive in terms of drug use. You know, that somebody could say, okay, oh, this is what you do.
That was those pages.
Right. I mean, but what happened, you know, it's like I'm thinking like, okay, I mean, my Hemingway and I know how to fish. And what happened, I tell somebody when I'm teaching memoir class and workshops that you want to have something in your book where you say, okay, if you want to know how to do such and such, mm-hmm. this is what you do. I remember I was reading Philip Glass's memoir, you know, the composer, and there's a point in it where he tells you how to drive a cab in New York. We're not talking about experimental music. We're just talking about how to manage 42nd Street. Right. And so what happened, I said, wow, and I'm looking at this. And then I go back to what I was asking you when you were talking about your father and teaching the math. I said, I wish that you and your father sitting looking at a math problem, whatever, had been like 2 pages. Because in here, for you, you described this drug use. I like said, "Oh man, this I didn't know." I remember the folks doing this. You know, I didn't do this, but you know, talk about that, because there's a change there, where, and this, I'll put you on the spot. Did you do this, Keith, to show that you have street credibility?
Wasn't so much that, just to really describe the process. That is one point. It was such a pivotal moment. Mm-hmm. You know, it's such a pivotal moment for me. Really just want to describe what the process was, you know? And so, you know, a lot of times you hear that to say, well, I did this or that. And you say, well, really? And so I really wanted to describe it, you know, which I actually had done before, actually, in an earlier work, a little different angle. But I just wanted to describe that.
Well, you know, if I was teaching young African-American men who were in the juvenile system, criminal system, I want to know how you, Keith, how you decided to stop doing the crime activity and the drug. What gave you the out?
It's in the book, man. It's hard for people, you know. Epiphanies are not rational, as I say. You know, mm-hmm. You get an epiphany, and actually, it was the Jonathan Jackson.
Right.
The case. I picked up the newspaper one morning and I read about what had happened, you know, out in San Marin County with Jonathan Jackson. And that really was, and Jonathan Jackson was younger than I was, mm-hmm. you know. And so, as I said, I always had this antenna tuned to a world beyond what we were doing in the street. So, it was the news. It was all this other kind of stuff. And it was always like a deferral, you know, like the trains were going to collide at some point, because the academic, and it did. I mean, the academic game is going to collapse. You can't keep both of these trains running on parallel tracks and mm-hmm. keep them separate. So there's going to be a collision. And it was, and you know, you know, my senior year, you know, I was absent 56 times in the last semester. So I had tuned school out, but it was always this sense of deferral. Like I will still go to college and stuff like that. That dream, I'll still do that. But the reality is that you're not going to do that if you keep doing what you're doing. But you think you can defer it. And I think what happened with the Jonathan Jackson episode is that you realize that you were an adult. It's like you weren't going to defer it. You're not going to Notre Dame. You're not doing any of this stuff. Look at what this kid is doing. He's a year younger than you are. And he put his life on the line because he had ideals and he was ready to move on those ideals, you see. Mm. And so it's interesting because when I was still on X, which used to be called Twitter, I actually got a tweet from Jonathan's son because I had texted something on Twitter and he got it and he said, man, thank you. You know, he thanked me for it and whatnot. So haven't been in touch with him yet, but you know, when Jonathan Jackson was killed, his girlfriend was pregnant. Hmm. So that baby was born later. And so that really was it. You know, that was the attempt that said, I gotta do something else. You know, like you Keith Gilliard, goddamn it.
but what's interesting,
you ain't Keith. Supposed to be doing this.
Right. But Keith, but what happens is interesting. You get sentenced to Rikers Island, and you say in your book, half the neighborhood seemed to be on Rikers Island.
Yeah. Everybody was there. I could probably name 30 names right now, you know. And so that's what was happening. I mean, there was, as you know, like I think a quarter of the nation's heroin addicts were in New York City.
Right.
And you know, you're in the Bronx. You know the scourge came through. Bronx, Harlem, Queens, you know. If you had gone over to Rikers Island, you would have seen your neighborhood too.
Right. Well, you know when I saw, you know, I'm in the Bronx, is at one time I remember St. Mark's Episcopal Church, that if for like midnight, if you wanted to go, you were having trouble, the church doors was open, right? But right. When the junkies started taking stealing out of the church, the church locked its doors, you know?
Yeah. You know what it is.
Right.
Yeah.
But yeah. Let's get back to the Soledad brothers. And I mean, you mentioned Jonathan Jackson. Did you also become a person, you know, reading George Jackson's work?
Yeah, read George Jackson. Soledad Brother, Blood in My Eye. Not only that, but you know, as I say in the book, you know, I was living maybe like, let me see, one, two, three, maybe three blocks from the Corona branch of the Black Panthers. Mm-hmm. Actually, they were part of the Jamaica branch, but they had an office on Northern Boulevard. So that's about three blocks from my home. Mm-hmm. So it was all Panthers, you know. And the people who were in the Panthers, these people I grew up with. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, so you were listening, my next door neighbor, you know, for example. So you were talking that stuff, and I hanging at the library because my rehab center was the library, you know. I said, let me run into the library. And people say, have you seen Keith? Oh, he's probably down in the library.
Well, we'll talk about this on Langston. Talk about this Langston Hughes Community Library and Culture Center. I mean, I was there maybe twice, but I felt that was like a little hub.
Yeah, that was my spot. Yeah, that was my spot. That was two blocks from my home. So I thought that was very, I thought it was very thoughtful, you know, of neighborhood plans to put a library by my house. You know, I thought that was great. So yeah, that was it, man. It's even when I started school, I would take the bus to school out to Queensboro Community College. And when I got off the bus on Northern Boulevard, I just went to the library.
Were there any elders in the library? You know, when I was there, I saw elders like, you know, in that library. And I wonder, did you encounter any elders that became like mentors?
For sure. I think I talk about it in the book. I think one of the people that I talked to all the time was Elton Fax.
Mm-hmm. Elton Fax, right.
Elton Fax, the great illustrator, and also wrote books about his travels to Africa and whatnot. Elton was always in the library, and I would be at the table, and he'd be looking at, and I was like, why is this guy studying me? Because I think he was fascinated that a young person was so engaged in books, because I was going to the shelves, all the poetry books, you know. Mm-hmm. I'd get one, go through it, go get another, and I'd see him all the time. And so then we struck up a conversation one day, and he was sketching something, and he was showing me what he was sketching. And they had a couple of his sketches hanging in the library. Mm. I didn't know who he was. So actually, Elton Fax was the first writer, since he did publish books, he was actually the first writer that I ever met. Uh-huh. Yeah, and that was right then in Langston Hughes Library. And of course, there was, like I said, there was Brother Tyrone Bryant, who was the director. And that's when I started getting serious about writing again, like getting reacquainted. Mm-hmm. Writing, because we had a community newspaper called the Transition Press. And so I got on the staff of the newspaper, and they had the reporters from the New York Times used to come out on Saturdays and run a workshop. Hmm. And they said, if you come to the workshop on Saturdays, you get $5. And you got me, you know? So we used to come, maybe just cover the neighborhood, write stories. Some of them would be national.
Right.
The first piece I ever published was about the Angela Davis trial. Mm-hmm. And that was in 71, the summer of 71. And I told her that one time, because I introduced her at a conference in Indianapolis. And I said, man, she said, that's a long time ago. She said, I'm old. She said, we're getting old, you know, because I gave it a date, you know.
Right.
So, that was the library was the hub. And so everybody came to the library, too. They had a very rich cultural program. And mm-hmm. So that's why I fell in. I won't say fell in love, but that's when I first saw Jane Cortez.
Jane Cortez.
You know, just fell under her spell all the way.
Oh, you're the monkey man.
Yeah, yeah. You know, just fell under her spell, man. Jane was the idol. But I remember Nikki Giovanni coming to the library. Mm. Felipe Luciano came to the library.
Well, let's talk about the Black Arts Movement. And I know, and you mentioned in your memoir the importance of Black Fire, the anthology that Larry Neal and Baraka. But talk about the, you know, some of the writers that you met personally, but also in terms of how should we teach the Black Arts Movement?
I think one of the things with Black Arts Movement, I think we have to extend the time frame. Mm-hmm. Because you've had some critics, they put a time frame on it.
Okay, when do you begin it? When do you begin the Black Arts Movement?
I talk about it. Actually, you know, you have like a precursors to it. Mm-hmm. I don't see how you can leave Langston out.
Right.
Then when you do stuff like, when you read stuff like Ash Your Mama and stuff mm-hmm. like that, Don't see how you can leave that out. And then when you think about Wright, when you think about Richard Wright's extensive use of Black language and folklore in his work, don't know how you can leave that out. And so when you think about Margaret Walker, don't know how you can leave that out. So
yeah, that's very interesting, because if you take Baraka at Baldwin's funeral, he says the Black Arts Movement begins with Blues for Mr. Charlie by James Baldwin. And you see a lot of the things that rest in that play that pretty much defines, you know, Black power and Black art.
Yeah.
When would you end the Black Arts Movement?
I wouldn't end it, actually.
Oh, you wouldn't end it?
Because I think that, like, this is what I'm saying, the critics have done. They give you 1965 is
right.
And then they say 75 is over, you know, that kind of stuff. And I was saying, wait a minute. There were writers who were not celebrity writers or well-known writers or famous writers who were also part of that movement. They were the ones in the audience.
Right.
Listening to this stuff. So it influenced them. So how do you trace out all those lines of influence?
Well, you know how I do it. I ended at 74 because I used the Sixth Pan-African Congress as a divide, because that's when the delegation splits between nationalists and Marxist-Leninists.
Oh, I get that. But what about the audience?
Well, the audience, they didn't fly to the conference.
No, yeah. I mean, but what about the audience for the artists is what I'm saying.
Right.
Young folks, in other words, you and I, maybe a step behind when the height of that was happening. But I would say we were like a 1.5 generation.
Right.
So not Black ours. We weren't 30.
Right.
We weren't 30 in 1967. But we were listening and reading to this stuff.
We were the believers.
Yeah. How about it? Yeah. So I would say we like a 1.5 generation. And so to me, unless you can really account for all those lines of influence, I don't know how you can establish an end date.
Well, let me mention something about you, two people. Larry Niels would say that, and he's mentioned this in his one of his essays, the Black Arts Movement is the spiritual sister of the Black Power Movement.
Right.
Then I remember Marvin X coming, Marvin X talking about, he said, no, the Black Arts Movement was more like the mother of the Black Power Movement.
I probably would go with Larry. Because of Malcolm, because of the document that they published, the statement and aims of the Organization of Afro-American Unity. And in that and in that statement, that manifesto, which was written by Killens and Clark, along with Malcolm's input, he laid out the basis for a cultural revolution and called for a cultural revolution in the arts and in the communities, and how artists would draw from the community and give back to the community. This predates, like, the Black Arts Repertory Theater School. So I would say that the Black Power call is, I think Larry has the best.
See now, Marvin's saying that some of the people that we see as activists were actually writing poetry. Like, you take Newton, they were actually writing poetry and stuff before they became even you go back, Julian Bond and some of these folks, while they were in SNCC, they're writing poetry.
Oh, yeah. Charlie Cobb.
Charlie Cobb, right, yeah.
Yeah, you know. No, for sure, you know. So, you know, like all these things, man, when you try to establish boundaries, you know, it gets a little... These boundaries are always complicated.
Well, that's why I come to you, man. You got a chair named after you, man. You already Edward Earl Sparks professor.
But what I'm sure about is I don't agree with is the end date.
Right, I don't end it
in the mid 70s where the scholars do. In terms of who was what where and who lit the first match. You know, I dated with Malcolm, because even though there were precursors to the writers that published after 65, he lit the flame, surely. Mm-hmm. I mean, Baraka even talks about it. Like, I'm down in the bookstore and I got the news.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I got to leave the village. Right. I got to go uptown.
Right.
So I think that's a good origin story, even though, you know, it's not the absolute origin story, but I think it's a good enough origin story for me.
I don't want to end this program without you talking at some length. We're talking about the Black Arts Movement. Talk about the importance of John Oliver Killens.
Well, I think John Oliver Killens was major. He was in the middle of a lot of things. And he's the link, really. I think when you look at the 50s generation, the 1950s, if you go back and look at that decade and the writers who came to maturity in that decade and follow their careers, I think you can make an argument that they produced more than the Harlem Renaissance did. I think Killings was important because he, as Tony K. Bambara talks about, he was the major novelist. That's why John A. Williams and Addison Gale and them look toward him. They call him the father of a generation of African-American novelists because he took it from what some people call the Reitheim school of social pathology and the individual against the environment is pathological. John Killings took it, if you look at the title, for example, if you go back and you look at Wright, you know, Native Son, Individual, Ellison, Invisible Man, Individual. When John comes along with Youngblood, he uses a family surname as a title. You know, he doesn't use an individual, he uses a surname. So he was the one who sort of broke from the Reitheim School of Social Protest and brought family, brought the Black family into the heart of his fiction and was very concerned. Some people criticized him for it, Howard Cruz for one, but he brought like positive images and whatnot into the literature. But I think he was also important beyond his work as a writer. I think he was important as a cultural orchestrator.
I think that, you know, that's how I think of him because it's the Harlem Writers Guild. I think that when I interact with him at Howard, he is key to the African-American Writers Conferences.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know,
he started that in 59.
Right.
With the AMSAC, American African Culture. He had that conference. And that's when Howard Cruz was already getting on his tape.
This is where I came in because I was reading Howard Cruz, right? And what happened, we're planning these conferences, it's like Killings, Hakeem Adebooty right now. And I was like, wait a minute, Killings, you are inviting your same friends from New York down here, right? And I remember me and my friend Amazu Baldwin, we trying to get like, well, we should be inviting Samuel Delaney. And then somebody, I think it was Hakeem, said, well, what has he written? And so we went and got a copy of Dahlgren and said, well, this is what he wrote. And your book was very fascinating because I didn't know the relationship between Killings and George Davis.
Oh yeah.
See, because he was pushing George Davis to be on a panel at the conference, and I'm saying, "Well, who's George Davis? What has he written?" your book is so valuable, Keith, because it takes people beyond. You know, this is Killings is so important. You know,
after AMSAC in 59, then he did the conference for Lorraine Hansberry in 60.
Right. Oh,
then the FIST conferences. 66, 67, 68, then on to Howard.
Right.
On to New York.
Yeah. We would have no Haki, no Nikki if he didn't have those conferences.
Right.
You know?
So he was Nikki's teacher as well.
Right. So talk about how you took on, you know, writing about Killings. Okay. Well, you know what? Okay. That's another program. We could come back and do a program just on Killings. Okay, Key? Because he's that. Okay. We're going to stop here because we've been instructed to stop. Okay. We by executive order. Anyway, I didn't say that. My guest today has been Keith Gilyard. He is the Edwin Earl Sparks Professor of English and African American Studies at Pennsylvania State University. We've been talking about his books, The Promise of Language, a memoir, and also On Location, a book of poetry, published from Third World Press University Foundation. And so, Keith, thank you very much. Okay. The show's on the margin. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
Thank you.
The WPFW Local Station Board's Relocation Committee is in the process of re-envisioning what studio space for a progressive, community-based, and community-supported radio station should be in the coming decade or more. We wish to ensure that a new, more permanent home will meet current needs and those less foreseeable in the future. All WPFW stakeholders, listeners, donors, programmers, staff, community activists may share their thoughts and insights about the future space by taking the location survey located on the WPFW homepage. Be creative in your answers. The future belongs to those who dream big. The survey may be found at www.wpfwfm.org. Please submit your answers by June 30th. Thank you for your thoughts and time.
We are going to march to the White House, and we are going to deliver a message. Trump must go now.
This 4th of July, refusefascism.org is saying, don't celebrate Trump's fascist America. Protest. Don't barbecue with family. While immigrant families are being ripped apart, troops are in the streets, elected officials are being threatened and arrested, and fascism is advancing. No, the lesson of history is that fascism must be defeated before it becomes too late. That is why on July 4th at 2 p.m. at Logan Circle, refusefascism.org will rally and then march to the White House to declare independence from Trump's fascist America in the name of humanity. Then, right in front of the White House, they will raise the biggest chant heard round the world.
Trump must go now!
Trump must go now!
Details and to get involved, refusefascism.org.
This July 4th, WPFW presents Higher, the poetic genius of Sekou Sundiata and the musical innovation of Sly Stone. From 9 a.m. until 7 p.m., we begin at 11 a.m. with an airing of Sekou Sundiata's 51st Dream State, a multimedia meditation on empire. At 1 p.m., our multifaceted exploration of Sly Stone kicks off until 7 p.m. with tributes curated by Brother Jamil, James Funk, and DJ Lance Reynolds. Full schedule at WPFWFM.org. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Greetings. WPFW is pleased to announce the relaunch of our major donor program, now known as the Jazz and Justice Circle. If you gave $1,000 last year or so far this year, you are automatically enrolled in this cherished group of listener members, and we thank you. Benefits of your membership are at WPFWFM.org under the Support Us tab at the top of the homepage is the Jazz and Justice Circle. Interested in joining this select group? Please consider a donation of $1,000 or more online at WPFWFM.org. Your donation helps WPFW build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
While Medgar Evers and Patrice Lumumba were not personally acquainted, their lives and struggles are often commemorated together due to the parallels in their commitment to fighting for the self-determination and liberation of African people. WPFW celebrates the centennial of this parallel vision with From Mississippi to the Congo, 100 Years of Lumumba and Medgar, Wednesday, July 2nd, noon until midnight on WPFW. Building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
The Birchmere presents Omar, July 17th, Hubert Laws, July 20th, Hiroshima, July 24th, and Sheila E., July 30th. Details at thebirchmere.com.
The Youth Resiliency Institute's annual Cherry Hill Arts and Music Waterfront Festival is back on Friday, July 4th, 1 until 10 p.m. at Middle Branch Park in Baltimore. Music, food trucks, children's activities, vendors, art exhibition, and more in celebration of the 15th anniversary of the Youth Resiliency Institute. Performers include Navasha Dea, Cecily, DJ Grin, and Fusion Orchestra, and more. Details at cherryhillfest.com or 443-813-2116. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Wondering how to get WPFW swag in your life? Items that say, I support Jazz and Justice without saying a word. We've got you covered. details and browsing at WPFWFM.org. Again, that's WPFWFM.org.
Award-winning former police officer and criminal justice adjunct professor Garland Nixon hosts News Views Fridays at 6 p.m. Tune in.